Chapter 18. On Grey Wings. Spear Thrust. Alignment. Unnamed warship, inner system Gulf. The grey ship flew. It left the call of Jupiter. None of the guns it passed turned to follow it. None of the ships holding station moved to mark its passing. All Spexes that looked at it found their augurs turning away, their questions answered by cipher codes that removed even the beginning of the question. On it flew, grey in the night, a shadow at the edge of sight, into the dark, towards the glimmer that was the sun. Mercedes looked back at Jupiter as the gas giant shrank. An enhanced pane of vision had opened in front of the circular viewport. She could see the lights of void engagements. The ships of the invaders were coming from the outer system in growing force now.
"The Vanguard," said Loken softly, coming to stand beside her.
She had not heard him enter. No hiss of door pistons or thump of locks, and his armour followed his movements without a sound. The chamber that they waited in was small, but with a high ceiling and a lone viewport set into its wall. It was a small and quiet space, a refuge of solitude on a ship of whispers. The servitors that she had seen had been hooded in grey, and moved with fluidity and in silence. The ship itself did not growl or tremble with power, but slid through the night seemingly without effort, gathering speed in silence. Mercedes looked around at Loken, who nodded at the image of the orb of Jupiter.
"The enemy have loosed jackals to harry our lines. The true force is still crossing the Gulf from Uranus. It will be in battle range in hours."
He let out a breath.
"And then those lights will seem just the sparks falling before the inferno comes."
She twitched, and he looked around to meet her gaze.
"The humans you brought from Uranus will be free of the planet's sphere by then. They have been put on ships, and those ships sent out amongst the asteroid colonies."
"Thank you,"
she said quietly.
"It may not save them," said Loken. "There are no safe places anymore. But you brought them as far as you could."
Mercedes did not answer, but looked around. Maury and Noon lay curled together beneath a blanket under the light of a glow globe. They had refused to leave her, and so had come with her onto the grey ship. They had slept most of the time since then. Perhaps they had succumbed to exhaustion and shock, or perhaps the sense that they had finally reached a place of safety had given them the gift of rest. That gift had not been given to Mercedes. Things like the shadows of wolves had been waiting for her during the few moments in which she had closed her eyes. Perhaps it was the presence of Loken, or the quiet of the ship, but she found memories coming to her, sharp and unasked for. Malaghurst the Twisted, looking down at her, his eyes hard, the corridors of the vengeful spirit, a smell of blood and smoke. She shivered and blinked. Loken was still looking at her, eyes steady, face unmoving. For a second, in the reflected light of Jupiter, he looked almost human.
"How long?"
she asked, trying to suppress the tremor running through her nerves.
"There are no ships swifter than the one we stand on," he said. "It will not take us long, but we may arrive to find that the enemy has made that journey too. There are traitor forces moving into the inner system from above the orbital disk."
Mercedes glanced back at the sleeping children.
"It's not too late," she said. "We still have time. Not much, but some."
"How do you know?" he asked.
"I can feel it," she replied. "It is like the cogs of a device turning just on the edge of hearing. It is still turning."
Loken opened his mouth to say something.
"Captain Loken," said Malaghurst.
The image of the War Master's equerry turned its gaze on her.
"He trusts you."
"I am a remembrancer. I am recording his experiences for posterity."
"Remembrance. A strange idea to take to the stars, I've always thought."
"I don't understand."
She thought of looking around, but that cold gaze held her.
"I thought I was to be returned to my quarters," she said.
She had been taken from the training decks on the Vengeful Spirit by the bodyguard Maggard and a squad of soldiers. Cinderman and the others had been peeled away under their own guard, but Maggard had stayed with her, leading her through passages and corridors that she had not seen before. After a while he had stopped, and he had gestured at a door leading off the corridor. Mercedes, the blood roaring in her ears, had not moved until Maggard shoved her forwards.
"Tell me," said Malachurst, his power armour buzzing as he shifted. "Does she trust you?"
"What?"
"Does Captain Loken trust you?"
I don't...
"He favours you, talks to you, shares his remembrances with you. I think that he does trust you a great deal, Mercedes Oliton."
The equerry to the War Master had smiled, and unwilled she began to turn to run. A hand on her shoulder stopped her dead, heavy fingers squeezed with the smallest amount of pressure and the promise of bone-breaking force.
"You see, Mistress Oliton," said Malachurst, "we do not trust him at all."
"Is there something wrong?" asked Loken.
Mercedes found herself leaning against the armour glass of the viewport. Distant explosions flashed like tiny stars under her fingers. She shook her head, swallowing a breath that tasted cold in her throat.
"Memories," she said, blinking. "Just memories."
But that memory of Malachurst had not happened, said a voice in the back of her mind. What she had just remembered had never happened. She had been taken from the training chambers and returned to her quarters at Malachurst's orders. It had not happened.
"Memories of what?" he asked.
"You, Cinderman, the vengeful spirit, how this all began?"
He looked like he was going to ask a question, when a light blinked in the collar of his armour. She heard a low chime and the clatter of a voxlink connecting and decrypting. Loken turned his head to listen to words only he could hear.
"So ordered," he said after a second,
and began to move towards the door.
"A major engagement is in progress around Luna. We will have to chart a course to skirt it."
Mercedes nodded, still trying to grasp the strand of the memory that had risen in her mind. It was fading, though, sinking back beneath the surface of the immediate, slipping through her grasp. There was something she had forgotten.
"Loken,"
she said as he moved away. He stopped and looked over his shoulder.
"There was a navigator on the prison ship who escaped with me. I've not seen him since we reached the call. Was he amongst the refugees that got off the ship?"
Loken gave a small shake of his head.
"I do not know. I saw no navigator, but it is possible."
A laugh came to her lips as a thought struck her.
"You might have known him. Before, I mean, during the Crusade. He was a navigator on the Thunderbrick, part of the 63rd Expeditionary Fleet. Nihilus Yashar."
"I never met a navigator of that name," he said, and shrugged.
"The universe is smaller than it seems sometimes, isn't it?"
Loken frowned.
"Is there a reason why he would try to hide from you,
and then flee without telling you?" She thought of Nihilus, of how the Imperium had tried to imprison and kill him ever since he had returned to it.
"Every reason," she said.
The Phalanx, Terran Orbit. The Phalanx moved by the will of Rogel Dorn. Greater than any ship of the Imperium, it was a moon of gilded armour and stone. Gun fortresses rose in mountain ranges on its spine, and launch bays dotted its surface. A skin of atmosphere and ash from its engines surrounded it. Sunlight gleamed from the glass set in the cities borne on its back. It was not a ship. That was too small a title for it. It was war and empire given form and set amongst the stars. Kilometre-long cones of fire stretched in its wake as its engines began to pull it up the incline of Terra's gravity well. Its court of ships came with it, the Regis Astra, the Eagle of Inwit, and the Noon Star, warships all, and around them the attendant destroyers and strike cruisers that held the honour of being heralds to the Empress of War. Su Kassen fancied she could feel a tremble as the great ship began to move. She and half of the command staff had relocated with Rogel Dorn to the Phalanx's command bastion. It was a fortress grown from a greater fortress, a third of a kilometre long. The command bastion rose in two towers of black stone linked by bridges of plasteel and marble. The bridge, command seat of the ship, was the aftward tower. The forward and broader of the two was the strategium. From the bridge, the chosen captain of the vessel commanded the phalanx's movement. From the strategium, the master of a legion commanded crusades and conquests. At this moment, Rogel Dorn stood in the strategium, linked by Vox and Hololith with shipmaster Sura on the bridge. The strategium itself hung in tiers from a domed roof above a plain of crystal, over a hololithic pit 30 meters deep at its midpoint. Blue light flooded the space, rising and rippling from the tactical projections emanating from the pit. Command staff, tech priests and legion warriors looked down into the bowl of light, focusing on portions of the displays through lenses and screens. Dorn, Suka Sen, Arcamus, and a clutch of senior command staff stood on a platform directly above the holopit's centre. Huskals, in Indominatus Terminator plate, stood amongst the tiered galleries, immobile and watchful. Most of the staff in the strategium had been here when Dorn and his retinue arrived, a mirror of those in the Bab Bastion's Grand Borealis strategium. They had assumed their duties seamlessly.
"Signal the fleet elements in Terran orbit," said Dorn, as data lenses rose around the platform edge. "All forces to integrate to our command. All are to stand by for engagement order."
He had given the order to move his command to the phalanx 2 hours before, and the transports had been in the air and reaching for the heavens minutes later. He had not given his reasons, but Suka Sen had seen half of the catalyst and guessed the rest in his words. She had wondered if it was now, after the weeks of feeling the darkness and the threat of fire rolling closer, that he needed to take up the sword, not in principle, but in fact. The fires of war could be seen as Luna rose in the night sky above the palace. And so now, Rogel Dorn would throw the traitors back into the dark with his own hand. The pit of hololight began to flare and boil. Suka Sen began to siphon off information from the wider battlesphere, stretching her awareness out to the engagements around Mars, folding in the intelligence from Uranus, Neptune, Saturn, and Jupiter. The solar system was ablaze. Battle data spiraled and multiplied as she watched. In places where there was need, she issued orders that would commit ships to battle. In others, she pulled back what she could and watched the loss increments rise and rise. This was a war now measured in casualty estimates, lives spent by the thousand, because if they were not, then what life would remain for anyone? This was her role, her duty, while Dorn turned his will to where it was needed, to the point where it could tip the scales of battle. An alert light blinked at the edge of her sight, from where the personal signal channel controls rose in a pillar of brushed bronze. "Admiral," said the officer a second later. "My Lord Praetorian." She turned. "There is a ship closing at speed. It bears the clearance of the Lord Regent." Dorn was turning to look now too. "It says that it brings someone you must see."
"Who?" asked Dorn.
Battle Barge War Oath, Luna. The defenders knew the weapons of their attackers. The protectors of Luna, the veteran regiments, the ships of Su Kassen's fleets and the warriors of the 7th and 9th Legions knew that every thrust and manoeuvre of the assault had one aim: to allow the Sons of Horus to bring their legionary forces to bear on the surface and in the subsurface warrens of the moon. Centuries ago, when the same legion had spearheaded the conquest of Luna for the Emperor, the same had been true. The difference now was that Luna was not defended by the weapons of a gene cult of old night, but by the arms and might of the Imperium, and those defences held the assault to the vacuum above. Fire circled the moon. Rolling impacts struck void shields and peeled them back in flashes of light. Chains of plasma annihilators mounted on the lunar ring spoke in sequence, one gun cooling while another poured sunbright energy into the enemy ships. Swarms of bombers and interceptors spun amongst the fields of fire, thousands of tiny battles squeezed between exchanges that burned the dark like the fury of ancient gods. 30 Solar Auxilia bombers dodged through the grids of fire surrounding the Sons of Horus bombardment vessel, Chieftain of the Red Blade. They were about to unleash their payloads, just as a broadside struck the ship's void shields. Arcs of discharge from the collapsing shields overloaded the bombers' systems. They slewed off course, ploughing into the gun ports of the ship. Their payloads detonated. Fire punched into the Chieftain of the Red Blade's gunnery decks and cooked off a macro shell being hauled towards a breach. Explosions ripped through the ship from the inside. The Blood Angel ships, Red Tear and Lamentation of War, cut wide of the close formations of the main fleets and came about to unleash boarding torpedoes into the flanks of ships vying for the gulf between Luna and Terra. Each torpedo carried 10 sons of Sanguinius. All had painted a portion of their armour with the black saltire of a death oath. Each knew that he would fall in this fight, and that his oath of moment would be his last. The twin ships fired as their torpedoes ran on to their targets. Plasma and macro shells struck the attacking ships just as they were trying to find range on the closing ordnance. The torpedoes struck home and stabbed deep. Melter charges in their nose cones detonated. Walls and bulkheads became vapour. The Blood Angels' squads charged out of the torpedoes. Orange light caught wings of gold and silver worked into their red armour. They had chosen their targets well. Ships carrying Sons of Horus from the 21st, 345th and 71st companies. The Blood Angels met their traitor brothers. Blades lit with lightning. Bolters poured fire into armoured bodies. Broken ceramite shell casings and blood fell to the deck. And on the fight went, spread in a shifting crescent around Luna. Abaddon felt the charge in the air around him as the War Oath's teleporters built with power. He could taste metal and ash on his teeth. Layak stood at his shoulder, the two blade slaves seeming to shiver in the warp-charged air. His brothers were around him. They were all there. Thonas, Gedafron, Tybar, Ralkor, Sykar, Justerin, Reavers, warriors clad in black and marked with red and gold. And behind them he could feel the presence of all the rest, dead in all but memory. Sejanus, Syracul, Torgadon, Gull, Kars, Dusk, Greydon. Silent ghosts watching him as he took his sword from the hand of a serf.
"We shall become death," said Layak.
Incense smoke was fuming from his staff.
"Our knives shall become the spears of angels, our hands the thunderbolts of the gods."
Abaddon turned his gaze on the priest, who looked back at him with eye lenses like burning coals.
"I am glad, Abaddon, that I stand with you now at this sacred moment."
Abaddon turned and gave the first order.
"Full speed."
The War Oath's engines burned brighter. The ship had been prepared for this moment in its long fall from above the solar disk. Disciples of Kelbor Hal had worked in its engine spaces and generatoria decks. They had modified and mutilated, changed the nature of the ship from the inside. Only the shell of the one-time Imperial Fist's ship existed, the bones symbol enough for its purpose. As it leapt forwards, it screamed. Bulkheads began to vibrate. Plasma poured into reactor chambers and mixed with exotic energies. Speed built. The ships surrounding the War Oath peeled aside as it bore down towards Luna. They had protected and followed it as their flagship, but it was that no longer. The attacking fleet parted before it. The defenders saw it come, its speed building second by second. Orspex screens fogged and stuttered as sensors tried to lock on to its passage. In its hull, the crew that still lived spoke their prayers to the gods that had claimed their souls. Ships moved to block the War Oath's path, and its fleets moved to protect it in turn. Fire tore into their shields and armour. In the teleportation chamber, Abaddon felt his skin tighten inside his armour. Arcs of lightning split the air. The ships closest to the lunar ring moved aside as the great ship plunged down. The ring's guns fired, half-blind. Explosions tore the War Oath's shields and raked its flanks. Inside its engine spaces, tech priests in black robes intoned their last commands to its reactors and folded themselves out of reality. The ship accelerated in a last jet of flame. Sections of plasteel ripped free. The fire pouring from the defences broke its shields. Balls of lightning burst across its hull. 100-metre-long section tore from its prow and ploughed back across its spine, striking the bridge castle. The War Oath shrieked as it began to break apart. It was almost at the ring. Abaddon closed his eyes. "Activate," he said. The teleportation generators convulsed and threw them into the void beyond. A second later, the wounded ship struck the lunar ring. Shockwaves rippled through the vast hoop. The War Oath ploughed on for an instant. The ring twisted like rope. The plasma reactors and munitions in the War Oath's hull detonated. A sphere of energy exploded. Stone flashed to light. Metal became dust. The tremors spilled into the warp as the destruction rolled out through the materium. Then the occult energies laced into the ship's reactors flooded out. Paradox overtook reality. Fire unravelled substance. Light passed through stone and flesh. A 20-kilometre-long section of the ring vanished into a cloud of shadow. An aching instant of time unfurled. On Terra, the image of a black moon rose in the nightmares of those few who slept. Then the energies and the moment collapsed. Matter and light rushed back into the point where the War Oath had vanished. For a second, there was just an empty volume of space. Then glowing cracks lashed out, flowing through the void, threading through the space where ships still moved and poured fire at each other. The broken circle of the ring trembled, then began to fall, sliding back down into the weak grasp of the moon it had protected. Vast sections of docks and defences met the grey lunar surface. Clouds of rock and dust fountained up and up in the faint gravity. Abaddon opened his eyes. Around him the whirlwind of darkness became the smooth stone of Luna's caverns. There were figures moving beyond the settling shadows, clad in amber-yellow, guns firing, bolts and beams converging on him and the circle of warriors around him. Reality asserted itself like a hammer blow. "Fire!" he said. And around him, the first of Horus's warriors to set foot on the moon that made them obeyed. Comet Shrine, Inner System Gulf.
"Go!" willed Ahriman.
The gunship kicked free of the Comet Shrine. Around it, dozens of others flew free, engines bright as they raced for the ships already moving to make distance from the comet. Ahriman felt the universe turn under the surface of reality. Images bled into his mind's eye. The spin of the solar system above the night sky of Terra. The sages and sorcerers of ancient times, looking up and imagining the truth of the universe in the movement of stars. They were wrong, of course, but within their ignorance they were also right. They had thought that existence revolved around that old Earth. It did not. Not in the way they thought. The planets and stars and the arcing swirl of the galaxy turned without thought or care for the ball of rock that had spawned humanity. But another universe, one that lived in ideas and dreams, followed different rules. In that realm, the importance and power of objects and people did not follow the dry rules of atoms and gravity. Things made themselves important by the place they held in hopes and fears, and in the stories that people told themselves. And now, at this moment, this small sun and its circle of moons and planets truly was the axis of all existence. Ahriman saw Menkaura, his blind brother, floating in the centre of the Solitarium. Cords of light held him aloft as bloody and burning spheres turned through the air. Ahriman felt perception and time and space flatten and bend, felt his inner eye fill with a view that held everything from the sun's core to night's edge. Blood and pain and terror spilled into the warp and flowed inwards, cascading down through the patterns of old rituals and beliefs like the waters of a broken dam. It was all Ahriman could do to hold his thoughts steady in the enumerations. He felt the war oath strike the ring of Luna, saw the fire billow across the moon's surface. He tasted blood. Across his connection with Menkaura, he saw the symbols of the solar system slow in their orbits. Blood was filling the crystal sphere marked with the lunar sigil. The other spheres were glowing with flame and shadow. Everything had been for this. The assaults planned by Perturabo, the strike of the fleets deep in system, all had taken ground, killed, weakened defences. But more than that, they had formed this alignment, this moment of ritual power, written in the planets and stars. "Now," he said. And in the caverns of the Comet Shrine, the word-bearers who remained put their knives to the throats of the psychers chained to the floor. And as the mortals' death screams poured into the warp, the torrent they formed met the flood tide already surging in. Ahriman withdrew his mind, and had a second to feel his breath gasp ice from his lungs as the gunship accelerated away. The comet vanished. Time blinked. Night fell to blinding light. Sound. Voices. Night. Across the solar system, every being felt a tremor in their soul, like something stood behind them, but inhaling through their mouths. Then the sun went dark.